I taught physics for 32 years, and I sometimes frequent the Washington Post comment section, and my moniker is Gravity Strikes Again. And gravity has struck a couple times today. I knocked a mug, a precious mug, off the table, and it crashed to the floor, and it's now broken. And this microphone keeps getting lower and lower and lower. So I'll do the best I can to kind of hold it up, but gravity usually wins. So I'd like to begin my talk tonight with a cartoon. My favorite cartoonist, Bradford Veeley. And it shows an older businessman talking to a younger businessman. And the old man says, "Kid, never forget that every person you meet has a unique story to tell. And if you take time and stop to really listen to each one, I guarantee you, you'll hear something you can use against them when you most need it." So tonight, I'd like to explore the nature of story in our lives. Stories are everywhere in our lives. We've been telling stories since ancient times. We tell stories to our children at a very young age. We tell each other stories to entertain ourselves. Although this is what the Buddha advised against, we tell stories as gossip. And all of our fiction and our nonfiction consists of one story after another. We're enchanted by stories. Stories have the power to take us away. They have the power to put us in a kind of spell. And yet, in our meditation practice, whenever we're dealing with difficult emotions, we can usually find a story that we're telling ourselves. That story informs us that we're experiencing dukkha, the Pali word that means suffering or stress or some sense of unsatisfactoriness. And our intention in meditation is to move beyond the story to a deeper experience, to explore the ways in which we cling to a sense of self that ultimately gives rise to that story. So in this way, story becomes an indicator, a pointer toward a deeper understanding and wisdom. So examining story is a really important part of our journey. If we're ultimately going to free ourselves from the dukkha that the Buddha advised that we could, it's helpful to understand the nature of story in our lives, personally, culturally, as a species. So I'd like to take a look at some of the aspects of story to begin to poke holes in the ways that story enchants us. If we can begin to see story from the outside, then we can become disenchanted. Now, in our culture, the word disenchantment sounds like a bad thing. I was disenchanted. But if you really pay attention to that word, it's actually a good thing. When we're enchanted, we're under a kind of spell. We've lost our ability to examine. We're in a kind of daze. And we can be enchanted by all kinds of things, by people, by material possessions, by belief systems, and by stories. When we become disenchanted, we break the spell. We see things clearly. we can still value and love what we had previously been enchanted by, but we're able to experience reality just as it is. Experience deeply without being lost. So I'd like to start with a couple of ways in which we're manipulated by story, by ways we get enchanted. And the first is a focus on ending. There is an amusing movie called The Cup. It's about some Buddhist monks in India, and some of the young monks want to actually watch the World Cup, and so they have to negotiate with their elder monks. But in that movie, one of the young adult Buddhist monks is telling a story to a younger monk. He does it throughout the movie. He tells a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And then at the end of the movie, the young monk says, "Well, tell me the end of the story." And the older monk replies, "Who cares about endings?" And I recently heard a news story on National Public Radio on research that had shown that how a story ends dramatically affects our feeling about the story. So they used as an example listening to a recording of a beautiful piece of music. If at the end of the recording, before the piece had finished, there was a scratch or a sudden ending, then people hated the music, even though the rest of the piece had been enjoyed. And we do this with stories too. We love a story or we hate a story in large part because of how it ends. And yet, endings are arbitrary stopping places. Life goes on, and we can't ever really know the implications of one event or a series of events. This is brought home by a famous story, maybe you've heard it, I don't know, about a Chinese farmer who has one horse that he uses to sow his field. And this farm horse runs away. And all the neighbors come to tell him how unlucky he is. The farmer responds, "Well, maybe." And then the horse comes back and brings back another wild horse with him. Now he has two horses, and the neighbors come and tell him how lucky he is. And he responds, "Maybe." And then the son is trying to break the wild horse, and he falls, and he breaks his leg. And the neighbors come and tell the farmer how unlucky he is, and he responds, "Maybe." And then the army comes and takes away all the able-bodied men, but not the farmer's son because he has a broken leg. And the neighbors come and tell him how lucky he is, and he responds, "Maybe." And you can see from this parable that in life there's no place to mark end of story. How do we really judge whether something that happens is good or bad? While each event, each moment may be pleasant or unpleasant, we don't know how that event will affect the next event. Apparent blessings may be curses, apparent curses may be blessings, until at some point we stop seeing external events as blessings or curses, and just as events of life rolling along, kind of like the weather. And yet, even with the story I just told you about no endings, I had a subtle manipulation in there. Notice how I chose to end the story with the farmer being lucky. His son wasn't taken by the army. But I could have ended the story in a different place. I might have ended it with the son's leg being broken, and now the farmer had no one to help him tend the farm. So just notice your internal reaction when the story ends on a negative note compared to when it ends on a positive note. In the negative ending, we might say, "Oh, that's horrible," and really not take in the idea that this is just another event. This reaction is an indication that we're still enchanted by the story on some level. The other way that we get enchanted by stories is that we get manipulated by our subconscious or underlying beliefs. Now, movies and books manipulate us all the time. They give certain pieces of information and not other pieces of information. And movies are particularly manipulative through their use of music. Literally, nothing is happening on the screen. Somebody's walking towards a door. But this eerie music is coming, or this suspense music is playing, and we know something bad is going to happen. We're being told how to feel in each moment. Next time you watch a movie, see if you can pay attention to the musical score. It typically will try to tell you how you're supposed to feel at any given time. In the same way, our prior beliefs and prior experience tell us how to feel about stories. I'd like to do a little exercise with you. I'm going to tell you four statements, and I'd like you to just get a sense of what happens for you as I tell you each of these statements. The first statement is, John was on his way to school. The second statement, he was worried about the math lesson. Third statement, he was not sure he could control the class again today. Fourth statement, it was not part of a janitor's duties. Right. That little bit of laughter tells me that something happened, right? When I said John was on his way to school, how many of you saw a boy maybe somewhere between 6 and 15 years old? Right? Almost everybody, right? Maybe he has a backpack, maybe he's got a lunchbox, maybe he's riding a bike, maybe he's on the bus. But that's what came up automatically, right? We do this all the time. We get a little bit of information, and then we spontaneously create an interpretation around it based on prior experience and belief, held subconsciously. Now, that's not a bad thing, but where we get stuck is when we believe our interpretation to be the truth. Yeah. So we want to watch for that. These beliefs and these perceptions, they run underneath the surface of our conscious awareness. They tell us how to feel. For instance, I was once told a story by one of my coworkers, one of my fellow teachers, of a situation where a teacher we both know had fallen asleep during the class, lying on a table, and had fallen off the table. Now, the story was told really dramatically. It's kind of a mystery. We hear a noise, and we don't know what's happening until finally we discover there's the teacher on the floor. Now, for my coworker telling the story, who heard it from somebody else, her underlying belief system viewed the actions of this teacher with some scorn, a judgment of being unprofessional. And she was clearly telling the story in such a way that others would agree with her. When I heard the story, I had a different belief system, and I connected with a person who had a really stressful personal and or professional life and perhaps needed that sleep really badly at that moment. And for me, I felt compassion. Probably because I've had experiences of falling asleep in class. Standing up, that's not easy to do. And this, I hadn't planned this. I didn't know that this talk was going to happen in this moment. But we're in the midst of this whole question of the Covington teens and the elder, the Native American elder, and how everybody's interpreting what happened from their underlying belief system. It's another example of that. So when we tell stories to each other or to ourselves, we deliberately emphasize certain details and leave out other details. We want our audience, who's often ourselves, to react in a certain way, either with humor or outrage or scorn or sympathy or guilt. But if we told the story in a different way, we might get a totally different reaction or no reaction at all. How many of you have seen Tara Brach speak? And of course, all of you have seen Jonathan speak. Their jokes always land, right? They always land. But why do they always land? Because they tell them in a certain tone of voice, and then they tend to laugh at them themselves, cueing you how to respond. Often when I tell a joke, I remain deadpan, and often people don't even know I've told a joke. So what this leads to is that stories are abstractions from reality and interpretations of reality. They aren't reality itself. There's a phrase that kind of sums up this idea. Some of you may have heard it, especially in engineering firms. It's called, the map is not the territory. The map is not the territory. And what that means, in a literal term, is that a map is an abstraction from reality. It shows only a few surface aspects of the territory that it represents. Now, it may be helpful. If we're using a road map, it'll be helpful to get us where we want to go. But while we're on our way, or once we get there, it will not help us to explore the reality of the place, what the people are like, or the climate, or the architecture, or the geography, or the feel of the place. To understand the reality of the place, we actually have to be present for it, to be mindful of our experience. Stories, like maps, are abstractions of reality as well. Any story that is told highlights, perhaps exaggerates, certain details and ignores certain other details in order to advance the point of the storyteller. Actual reality is much richer and more nuanced than any story could ever be. For instance, my guess is we all know the story of the tortoise and the hare. Right? The storyteller, Aesop, arranges the details to advance his idea, his point, that slow and steady wins the race. One cartoon, however, highlights what Aesop left out of the story. It shows two tough-looking tortoises. They're talking. One tortoise is smoking a cigarette and carrying a gun. And the other tortoise says, "I'll place the bets. You just make sure to hit that hare with the tranquilizer." The story also relies on shared concepts, shared judgments about those concepts, which tend to be our experience of greed, aversion, fear. If we're living in concept, if we're living in judgments, then we get tugged around by the stories, gossip, novels, movies, television news programs all rely on this, that they can tug us around because of these underlying beliefs of fear, of greed. There's another cartoon by Betsy Streeter. It shows us watching a television broadcaster, and the broadcaster is saying, "Tonight, horrible things are happening. It's horrible. Could these horrible things be happening to you? Don't miss this story. You could be next. Horrible." That's pretty much what most news programs are like, especially on cable news. So when we consider all the passion and clinging and aversion that characterizes so much of our literature, we can summarize so many of our novels and movies as dukkha, followed by more dukkha, followed by still more dukkha, ending in dukkha. So we're tugged around by preconceived endings, and we're enchanted by story based on predetermined subconscious beliefs about life and about ourselves. And yet, viewed with mindfulness and wisdom, stories actually have the capacity to move us, towards greater understanding, towards greater awareness, towards greater depth of feeling and compassion, and towards greater freedom. We've all read books or seen movies that touch our hearts and that raise in us an innate sense of compassion. We've all read books or seen movies with characters that suffer because of their clinging or their aversion, but who eventually find some freedom as they let go of their clinging, thereby perhaps inspiring us to let go of some of our clinging. And many of our fairy tales and myths can be understood from a psychological viewpoint. The ogres and witches and demons are the shadow parts of ourselves. And we find happiness and freedom as we find the courage to turn and face those shadows directly. So we're not going to get rid of story. Stories are very ingrained in our beings. They help us to find meaning in life. In fact, every major religion suffuses its texts with stories. The Bible, both Jewish and Christian, the Quran, the teachings of the Sufis, and the Hindus all abound in stories. Even the Buddhist literature contains stories of the Buddha and his disciples, though I gotta say, the Buddhist stories are probably the least juicy of all of them. Since story is so ingrained in our beings, the key is to use story wisely, to help us to free ourselves from clinging and aversion, and to engender more kindness and compassion. So in my experience, story is most transformative if I approach it in two ways simultaneously. One way is to relate to the story, is to immerse myself in the story, to be part of the experience, so that I feel, as Zorba the Greek says, the full catastrophe. Here, I feel all the feelings. I judge and I criticize along the way. I root for the protagonist, often myself. I feel elation or sadness with each success or failure. That's one way. But the other way to relate to story is to bring mindfulness to the story. Here I know I'm witnessing a story. I'm aware that the story is an abstraction from reality, that it is only a limited way of looking at reality. I'm aware that my belief systems color and limit my experience. So I am in essence both engaged in the story and witnessing the story at the same time. We see the value of this twofold approach when we do a meditation of working with difficult emotions. When we experience difficult emotions, we're typically telling ourselves a story, perhaps more than one story. We are typically the protagonists on our stories, and we recount to ourselves certain things that were said and done, how certain actions were taken, how certain outcomes occurred. We note the meanings that we apply to the words and the actions and the outcomes, and then we typically experience feelings of guilt or remorse or anger or sadness or grief or fear. And we consider how what happened should have been different than what did and how I might have acted differently. And we plot out into the future what we might say or do to make the situation better, or look into the future and see some bleak landscape or some scary landscape, bringing a sense of hopelessness or anxiety. And we tell this story to ourselves over and over with the hope that somehow the result will change. If all I do is experience the immersion in the story, I see no way of relieving my experience of dukkha, of suffering. I'm caught in a set of beliefs and deep understandings that I am at best only dimly aware of. If I'm to free myself, I must bring these subconscious ways of thinking to light and to begin to evaluate how true they are, how useful they are, and the ways I relate to them. And this is done by using the story as an indicator that I'm experiencing dukkha, and then bring mindfulness to the story. Just telling myself, this is a story, to some degree wakes me up out of the trance of story, out of being lost in past and future, and brings me into the present moment. By recognizing I'm telling myself a story, I immediately also recognize that I am taking particular details from a big, broad swath of reality, and that my interpretation of those details is colored and limited by the particular set of beliefs that I'm holding, which are at best only partly true and only partly useful. I may not yet be aware of that wider reality or of those tightly held beliefs, but the mere awareness of the perception of story gives me some space to start to explore. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time practicing with you. I'll invite you to find yourself in a bit of a meditative position. And I'll invite you to close your eyes and bring your attention to your breath. And I'll invite you to bring to mind some situation that brings you some degree of difficult emotion, some reactivity. Now, for the sake of practice, it's probably best to work with something not so reactive causing. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most stressful, maybe picking something between a 3 and a 6. And allowing yourself to experience the situation as best you can, to recreate it in your mind's eye, sensing your environment. If it's a whole story, finding a representative moment and sensing where you are as clearly as you can. Noticing who's there or what else is there. Noticing what's being said or done. Aware of your reaction, perhaps what you're telling yourself. You might notice your experience as you scan your body for any sensations associated with this situation, perhaps noticing various tensions in the body or flutterings, tinglings, heat, queasiness, nervousness. Noticing your emotional state in this moment, naming it as specifically as you can, without judging it as being wrong. It's just what's here. And noticing the state of your mind. Perhaps your thoughts are rapid or slow or non-existent. Perhaps your thoughts are light and fluffy or dark and stormy. What's my mind like in this moment? And then I'll invite you to tell yourself, to remind yourself that this is a story. It's just a story. It's just a small part of reality, and I'm picking out certain details to remember. Somewhere inside of me, I'm clinging to some beliefs that are causing me to interpret this story in a particular way that's causing me distress. It might, again, be helpful to bring attention to the body sensations associated with the distress, maybe even just breathing in and out of the sensations as you remind yourself that the story is holding you in a kind of trance. Perhaps noticing how the awareness that this is a story has an effect on your relationship to the story. Perhaps giving you a little bit of space from it. You're experiencing the story, and at some level, you're witnessing the story at the same time. I'm going to invite you to imagine that you have a workbench in your mind and that you can take this whole story and put it down on the workbench. The story is still present. It will still inform you, but you won't be holding it with all of your being, with all of your mind. And maybe taking one or two slightly deeper inhales and with the exhale, letting out a little bit of a sigh, just to soften the grip on the story for the moment. And now I'll invite you to become aware of yourself sitting in your chair, almost as if you could step outside your body and look at this beautiful being that's sitting in this chair. And then allowing your awareness to expand to the size of this room. Sensing all the people who have gathered here, who are meditating with you right now. Aware that most of these people are experiencing suffering, dukkha, to one degree or another. Allowing your awareness now to expand to the size of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. You might sense into all the variety of people, young and old, and different races and religions and ethnicities and cultures and languages. And all the various stresses and strains, sufferings and challenges, as well as the moments of joy. And expanding your awareness now to the size of the United States, bringing awareness to the various peoples in the cities, in the countryside, in the suburbs, in the farms, people in wealth, people in poverty, and everything in between. Each individual with his or her own set of joys and sorrows. And perhaps having an awareness of the landscape, the mountains and the prairies, the green forests and the deserts, lakes, rivers, oceans. And expanding your awareness now to the size of the entire earth. Aware of all the various peoples of the world. Working and loving, laughing and crying, arguing and reconciling. Noticing places of calm and places of war and desolation. Places of prosperity and places of poverty. Sensing the variety of landscapes, of plant life, of animal life. And expanding your awareness one last time, not one last time, we've got two more times, expanding your awareness to the entire solar system. Aware of the Earth as one of eight planets and numerous asteroids and comets whizzing around the sun at thousands of miles per hour. And the sun, with its tons of fusion bomb-like reactions occurring every second, pouring out vast amounts of heat and light, a tiny sliver of which reaches the Earth, allowing all life on Earth to be possible. And now expanding your awareness one last time to encompass the entire universe, with the sun as just one of an uncountable number of stars, and the Earth but the merest speck of dust, and the predominant experience is empty space. And now from this perspective, retrieving your difficult situation from the workbench, noticing how you're relating to it now. Perhaps things have changed in your body sensations, your emotions, your state of mind. So this exercise illustrates that there is way more happening than the events we have plucked out for our story. And that as we become aware of the greater reality, our experience of story starts to change. Now, if we had more time, we could also explore examining our beliefs and our deeper understanding to see where we're stuck, so that we can unhook ourselves. That would be the process of the rain meditation, which I understand Jonathan has gone over with you a number of times. But we won't do that right now. But I'd like to consider one more way that we can look at story. We each have a story that we tell about ourselves, about our life arc. The story that we tell ourselves and the way we interpret that story can dramatically affect the experience we have of our own lives and the lives of others. Meister Eckhart says, "Every creature is a story of God." Each one of us can look at our lives as a story of one way in which the divine, whatever that is unfolding. Somehow the universe or the life force or God manifested you just as you are without having to change or fix anything. Through genetics and evolution, through all the experiences and influences you've had, none of which you chose, you're the product. Now that may be hard to believe, that my life, just the way it has progressed, is a divine story. But I submit that judicious choosing of the story that we tell ourselves about our lives can have a profound effect on ourselves and our environment. And so to illustrate that point, I will end with, of course, a story. This comes from an unknown author, but it was relayed in Scott Peck's book, The Different Drum. And the story concerns a monastery that had fallen upon hard times. It was once a great order, but because of persecution, all its branch houses were lost, and there were only 5 monks left in this decaying house, the abbot and 4 others, all over 70 years of age, clearly a dying order. Now, in the deep woods surrounding the monastery, there was a little hut that a rabbi occasionally used for a hermitage. The old monks had become a bit psychic, so they could always sense when the rabbi was in the hermitage. "The rabbi's in the woods, the rabbi's in the woods," they would whisper. And it occurred to the abbot that a visit to the rabbi might result in some advice to save his monastery. The rabbi welcomed the abbot to his hut. But when the abbot explained his visit, the rabbi could say, "I know how it is. The spirit has gone out of the people. It's the same in my town. Almost no one comes to the synagogue anymore." So the old abbot and the old rabbi wept together, and they read parts of the Torah, and they spoke of deep things. And when the abbot had to leave, they embraced each other. He said, It has been a wonder that we should meet after all these years. But I have failed in my purpose for coming here. Is there nothing you can tell me that would help me save my dying order?" "No, I'm sorry," the rabbi responded. "I have no advice to give. But I can tell you that the Messiah is one of you." When the abbot returned to the monastery, his fellow monks gathered around him to ask, "Well, what did the rabbi say?" "The rabbi said something mysterious. It was something cryptic. He said that the Messiah is one of us. I don't know what he meant." In the time that followed, the old monks wondered whether what was the significance to the rabbi's words? "The Messiah is one of us." Could he possibly have meant one of us monks? If so, which one? Do you suppose he meant the abbot? Yes, if he meant anyone, he probably meant Father Abbot. He's been our leader for more than a generation. On the other hand, he might have meant Brother Thomas. Certainly Brother Thomas is a holy man. Everyone knows that Thomas is a man of light. Certainly he could not have meant Brother Elred. Elred gets crotchety at times. But come to think of it, even though he's a thorn in people's sides, when you look back on it, Elred is virtually always right, often very right. Maybe the rabbi did mean Brother Elred, but surely not Brother Philip. Philip is so passive, he's a real nobody. But then, almost mysteriously, he has a gift for always being there when you need him. He just magically appears. Maybe Philip is the Messiah. Of course, the rabbi didn't mean me. He couldn't possibly have meant me. I'm just an ordinary person. Yet supposing he did. Supposing I am the Messiah. Oh God, not me. I couldn't be that much for you, could I? And as they contemplated, the old monks began to treat each other with extraordinary respect on the chance that one among them might be the Messiah. And they began to treat themselves with extraordinary respect. Now, people still occasionally came to visit the monastery in its beautiful forest to picnic on its tiny lawn, to wander among some of its paths, even to meditate in the dilapidated chapel. And as they did so, they sensed an aura of extraordinary respect that began to surround the five old monks and seemed to radiate out from them and permeate the atmosphere of the place. There was something strangely compelling about it. Hardly knowing why, they began to come back to the monastery to picnic, to play, to pray. They brought friends to this special place, and their friends brought friends. And then some of the younger men who came to visit the monastery started to talk more and more with the old monks. And after a while, one asked if he could join them. And then another, and another. So within a few years, the monastery once again became a thriving order. And thanks to the rabbi's gift, a vibrant center of light and spirituality in the realm. So I would like to close with a quote from Nisargadatta Maharaj that I think sums up best our discussion today of how we work with story. He says, "Wisdom is knowing I am nothing. Love is knowing I am everything. Between these two, my life moves." Namaste.